This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, good afternoon, and welcome to the weekend edition of Woman's Hour. This week, we know that many more women than ever before are in work, but we also know that their employment can be insecure and poorly paid. What sort of jobs are women losing, particularly on the high street, and what is being done to try to save them? We hear your views on whether you would sacrifice having children to save the planet. And modest fashion is having a moment, but what is it?
People focus way too much of it being outer, so what you wear. So when I think about modesty, I think about the way I speak, the way I act and how I carry myself and how people perceive me as a Muslim woman. But then again, I feel like there's so many other people that could be modest. There could be people who just don't agree with wearing revealing clothing.
And we investigate the complexities of the female friendship.
I think that sometimes female friendships are shown as though they're soft and kind of fun and simple and kind of cute and you can kind of put them under the simplistic banner of like girl power. And actually they're the most essential and important relationships we will have in our lives.
Female friendship on this edition of Weekend Woman's Hour. We start though with Gail Porter, who back in the late 90s was one of the best known presenters on television in this country. She'd started her career in children's telly and then went on to Top of the Pops. She married and had a daughter. But then a naked image of her, taken for a men's magazine, FHM, was projected onto the Houses of Parliament without her permission. She'd long had anorexia and went on to develop alopecia in 2005. She suffered severe mental health problems, used drugs and alcohol, self-harmed, and was sectioned under the Mental Health Act and at one point was homeless and sleeping on a bench on Hampstead Heath. You can see a documentary about her life, Being Gail Porter, on BBC iPlayer. Jenny asked her if it had been hard for her to look back over her life.
I must admit, there were times when the director or producer would bring a DVD or, you know, some footage and say, look, that was you with your hair, that was you when you were young, that's when you had a flat and when you had some cash. Never had huge amounts, but I had enough to keep me comfortable. So there was, I'd say now, maybe half and half, you know, half really happy to watch it and half kind of sad. But when I first watched it, when they, you know, handed it to me when we started doing the documentary, I think I was about 98% brokenhearted, thinking, can we not just go back to the 90s for a little bit? But I learned a lot and had a great time. And I'm still having a great time. Just had a bit of a, quite a big wobble in between.
You met old friends in Edinburgh.
I did,
yeah. Also your father, your old boss on Top of the Pops. Why was it important to discuss with them what they thought of you?
The whole point of meeting up with them is because I thought that I was hiding everything extremely well. So if I did a photo shoot, as you mentioned before, I self-harmed. So I would cover everything up, thought no one had noticed. If I was not eating, I thought nobody was noticing because I'd take the food and then I'd manage to get rid of it. And so I thought I was completely in control of this entire situation. And so going back to see these people, it was quite interesting to see that they were saying, well, actually, we knew something was wrong, but we didn't know how to discuss it with you and how to bring it up. So I think that's a really important part of the documentary, to say to other people out there, you know, maybe you should talk up if you think something's wrong with someone. Because I think I probably would have pushed them away if they'd said, you know, why are you not eating, or why have you hurt yourself, or are you okay? I might have pushed them away, but I think now looking back on it, if they'd asked me a couple of times, I might have opened up a little bit more. So I think that's one of the things I'm really happy about with the documentary, is that the amount of people that have, you know, reached out to me, and I apologise right now because I've got so many emails and messages on social media, I'm trying to get back to everybody. The amount of people that have gone through this similar sort of things as me and don't speak to anyone. So I think we've done a great thing, and yeah, hopefully other people will be able to open up.
It seems the FHM photo was a real turning point. Why did you agree to be photographed naked?
Well, yeah, that's always a good point. It was the 90s, and I was getting carried away. My moods were all over the place. You know, I didn't think I was good enough, and then I thought I was great, and then I was terrible. You know, I was all over the place. And then I got asked to go in and do this photo shoot, and you know, at first it was sort of dresses, and then we'd had a few drinks, and then they said, oh, you know, we'll take a little picture of your bottom, it's not going to be going. And I, you know, I was a bit flattered. I was in one of my high moods, thinking, yes, this is great, you know. And I saw the picture, and obviously they'd edited it, and they showed me a tiny little Polaroid, and I thought, oh, do you know what, I'm going to show that to my nan and just look, you know, it's only my bottom. And I showed my grandpa, and he said, oh, I seen that bottom when you were little, it's no problem. So I didn't know that the whole country was going to see it, because it was just going to be a little piece in the magazine. And so I didn't think anything of it. I thought, you know, nobody's going to see it. And it was quite flattering for me. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to look back on this in a few years' time and go, I remember when my bottom was that pert.
What was your response when it ended up on the House of Commons?
Well, as you mentioned, I wasn't told about it. So, you know, I'm not a stupid girl. I knew the photograph was floating around somewhere. So I just was watching the news in the morning, going to do my teeth, came out, and there was my huge frame on the Houses of Parliament without me knowing. So someone sent me a message the other day, and they said, oh, is it just because you weren't paid? Is that what made you angry? And I said, well, I wasn't angry. I was just very shocked. And also, I wasn't prepared, because I think if I'd been asked, I would have obviously said no, because that's just a ridiculous thing.
It was in 2005 that you developed alopecia. What actually happened? Did the hair fall out all at once, or was it slow?
4 weeks it was. I was working in America looking for dead people, as you do. I was doing a programme called Dead Famous, and I just noticed clumps were coming out. And my daughter was 2 at the time. So I was thinking, you know, it could be my hormones, it could be, you know, mum stuff, because I know that a lot of new mums can lose their hair. And then, so I didn't think much of it. And then it was just getting more and more. And I was having a shower, and the water was coming up to my ankles because the bath was filling up, because all my hair was in the plug hole. And it was everywhere. And then I had just a few strands, and we were filming, and the lovely makeup lady said, do you want me to shave the rest off? And I said, just please, yes, because it was just crazy.
Now, in the documentary, you wear the most fabulous eyelashes, which, which I know have been added on.
Yes, they have been,
but
yeah.
But you've never tried to conceal your hair loss with a wig. Why not?
I think because it was so instant, I got such a shock. And my daughter handled it extremely well. And I thought, okay, she's fine with it. I was quite uncomfortable wanting to cover it up. And I just thought, well, if I'm going to be good at something, hopefully people, you know, who are going through chemotherapy or who are losing their hair and don't want to talk about it, do you know what? This is it. And I'm just going to take it. So I kind of thought, is this the best idea I've ever had? And I thought, yes, I think it is a pretty good idea. And so I think it took a couple of months of people to get used to me, and, you know, paparazzi's taking pictures going, oh, what's happened to her and what's wrong? And so that was quite hurtful. But then now, you know, I speak to so many people, and ladies and gentlemen stop me in the supermarket or in the street, whether it's, as I say, chemotherapy or whether it's, you know, alopecia. I get to chat to everybody, so I think, you know, a couple of months of me being uncomfortable made a bit of a difference for everybody else, hopefully.
Now, in the documentary, you go back to the Royal Free Hospital in North London, where you were sectioned.
Yep.
And even now, all this time on, it really upsets you just to be there. Why?
Well, being sectioned is not the most fun in the world. So it just reminds me of a really low time. I was in a bad place. I was in not the best relationship. I was drinking too much. I had no work. I had no hair. And I was losing my house because I couldn't afford to keep the rent up. And one thing led to another. Got taken in, got told I needed to be sectioned. And I was just in... It was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I was just given medication. So it upsets me, the fact that it was just, I was locked up and no one to talk to apart from the other people that were locked up. So some of them were absolutely great and some of them could be a little bit scary at times. And then, yeah, it just brings back a lot of bad memories.
And as I said, you did end up at one point sleeping on a park bench on Hampstead Heath. But...
That was only a couple of times, because when I was homeless, I had so many amazing friends that if they had room or time, that I'd get a bed or I could get a sofa. But of course, they're not always there and it got to the embarrassing stage. So there was a couple of times that I just thought, I don't know where to go and I can't afford to get somewhere to stay.
What did you learn from making the documentary about your mental health and that period of self-harming that you went through?
I think the most important thing I learned was that... I'm not on my own and I shouldn't have been embarrassed. And I think I just learned more about myself and I learned that I'm pretty resilient. I'm still here.
But have you found out what's at the root of the mental health problem?
Not really. I think it's just everybody's individual. So my moods can change from one minute to the next. And some people like to take medication for it. Personally, I'm going to be 50 soon, so I take it as it is.
Just one other thing. I noticed throughout the documentary you were wearing a necklace with the name Honey,
yes,
your daughter's
name.
Yes,
that's my daughter's name, just in case I forgot.
It. And you wore it all the time.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because she wasn't there with me, and I actually just saw it. It was a wee cheapy thing, so I just had it on all the time. And I think she was quite embarrassed about the whole thing, but I was constantly just holding on to it. Just, she was very proud of me. She actually watched the documentary last week, because I wasn't sure if she's 17 now, and she was quite moved by the whole thing. So she's the best girl. So yeah, I held on to it so much. It actually broke on the last day, so I need to go and get myself a new one.
Gail Porter talking to Jenny on Women's Hour this week, and a lot of people were really affected by that interview. Moira says, I just wanted to say to Gail how amazing she is and how important her documentary is in raising issues around mental health. She's honest, open and warm. Thank you for having her on as a guest. I've seen that documentary and I found it very moving. Long may she prosper. So there's a ringing endorsement from Moira. The programme is called Being Gail Porter and you can find it on the BBC iPlayer. The latest unemployment figures were out this week and the unemployment rate has barely changed. It is just 3.8%. And the government, not surprisingly, has made much of the fact that more women are now in work in Britain than at any other time. We also know, of course, that female employment can be insecure and is often poorly paid. And the high street in particular is doing badly. So what sort of jobs are women losing and what is being done to try to save them? We talked to Vicky Price, who's an economist and the author of a new book called Women versus Capitalism, and to Kate Bell, the TUC's head of economics. I put it to her that surely high employment rates for women were something we all ought to be celebrating.
It absolutely is. It's really good news. But what we're finding is that those high employment rates aren't solving some of the kind of structural problems in the labour market. So whether it's low pay for everybody or it's the fact that that persistent gender pay gap at the moment not set to close until 2058 isn't going away. So of course these figures are good news for women who increasingly want to be in work, but we've still got this huge kind of structural discrimination and high employment rates on their own won't solve that.
I can't imagine that you disagree with much of that, Vicky. Tell me.
No, and interesting when we look at the pay gap, of course, because a very large number of women, something like 43% of women who work, out of those figures that you quoted earlier, work part-time. And of course, very often they work at below their skill level the moment they start working part-time, which of course loses a lot in relation to productivity for the UK economy as a whole. But also the gap between the part-time hourly wage and the full-time pay for a man is about 35%, So if we look at the vast majority of women who work part-time actually not earning an awful lot, then you can see that gap being contained and sustained throughout the whole of their lives, more or less, because many women, 43% of them who work part-time, over a period of years, obviously, collect a lot less in terms of average earnings, and they end up with a lot less in relation to their pensions by the end of the day. And some of the increase we've seen in women labour force participation has been because they've had to carry on working, given the increase in the pension age, which has been introduced, yes, rather suddenly for some of them.
Yes, OK. So that headline, which looks rather wonderful, actually masks some rather more, some darker truths, if I can be so melodramatic. That pay gap of 35%, Kate, that is a worry, isn't it?
That's a huge worry. And I think it also reflects the fact that where part-time work is available tends to kind of drive the kind of occupational segregation we see. There's this kind of chicken and egg situation where work, which is predominantly done by women, is undervalued, partly because it's done by women. And then women end up in these part-time, low-paid roles, which continues to reinforce that gender pay gap. And I do actually think, though, kind of, if we're thinking about a new strategy for social care, surely that's an opportunity to say, how do we value this properly? And that has to start by paying people properly first.
Two things I really want to talk about, the high street and maternity leave. And Vicky, your stand on maternity leave is interesting. I mean, I think fundamentally you just think it's something women should avoid if possible.
Well, that's because the evidence shows that once you go off and take time off from work, you lose out almost forever, because if you come back part-time, as many women do, or one more flexible work, then quite often you lose out in relation to being trained and acquiring those skills that are necessary, and basically you no longer compete to the same level as whoever stayed behind and continues to do the work.
But we've got many, many thousands of listeners, I'm sure, right now on maternity leave. Are you saying to them, frankly, you're mugs?
No, it's very important to look after your children. But what should happen is that it should be shared properly with the men or with your partner. Therefore, there should be no discrimination in relation to a woman going off. So there would be an incentive for firms to carry on upping the skills of everyone and not considering women, for whatever reason, maternity being one of them, as being the types that they wouldn't want to hire to begin with. And second, they certainly wouldn't want to promote, because they would be less able to do the roles that they want them to do because they have children and they need to go and continue caring for them throughout their lives, or for a large part of their lives. So flexible working, in my view, and also absolutely subsidised, heavily subsidised childcare, if not free childcare, has to be, in my view, the answer, and absolutely sharing with the other person in their lives.
Kate.
And I think we've got a huge opportunity here, because we are hearing increasingly that men want to be spending time with their young children.
They might well say it, but it's not actually happening, is it?
One of the reasons it's not happening is because paternity pay is still so low paid. So we've got the entitlement at the moment is 2 weeks on statutory pay, which is just over £100 a week. And many men say they can't afford to take that. And that's why we've been calling for a long time for a much higher entitlement to paternity leave, and like maternity leave, to make sure it's paid at least for the first period at 90% of earnings. And you know, this is something we know that works. When we see kind of that being introduced in I'm afraid to say it's a bit hackneyed, but it is the Scandinavian countries introduced that, and their gender pay gaps are lower and they have much more equal sharing of care between women and men. And it's kind of, we've known this for a really, really long time. And I think one of the kind of frustrating things about this debate is we keep talking about the gender pay gap. We know what the answers are. We know it's around valuing care work more. We know it's about more equal pay for women and men. We know, like Vicky says, it's around big investments in childcare, and of course about that right to flexible working. And yet we've had inaction on this for a really, really long time now. And
yes,
frustrating.
We can continue to talk about it forever without apparently making huge amounts of headway, but we will plug on, I promise. So to the high street, which of course employs many, many thousands of women, and these jobs are going, Vicky. And what's the government doing to protect those jobs?
There's a real issue there. I mean, the thing to remember, particularly about women, is that many have been employed in the public sector and the civil service. And those numbers were cut very significantly during the austerity period of George Osborne and beyond. Many of them then found jobs elsewhere. But the women in the civil service and public sector generally are higher skilled, interestingly, than on average, than people who work in retail or people who work in the private sector. So that's the women, OK? The women who work in one area and the women who work in another. The moment they leave that type of employment and guaranteed pensions and so on that they had before, they move into a much more uncertain environment, which is exactly what has happened. And of course, in areas which are less requiring of the skills that they had before, and they earn less as a result. And those jobs are incredibly insecure. It's not just the gig economy. If you look at the retail sector, where many of them are gravitated to, what you find is that hundreds of thousands of jobs are being cut every year. The expectation is that something like 170,000 jobs will go again in 2020. A lot of them held by women because of introduction of technology, cutting costs. We've seen what's been going on in the retail sector.
To warehousing, for example.
Up to a point, but it isn't just the sort of online shopping that's taking place. It is also that firms are discounting like mad because the consumer only recently started seeing an increase in their real disposable incomes, and they've been very, very careful how they spend, and they only go for the cheapest things that they can find. So it's understandable that they would do it, but jobs are going in that area. So where will they go to next? Maybe the care sector we've already discussed, which pays even less. So it is a serious problem for women who have tended generally to be downwardly mobile in terms of their wages, particularly once they have children, but also once they change the way they work. And this trend that we have seen recently actually accentuates that problem.
Is there any, are you optimistic at all, Kate, in terms of what government intervention could do for preserving or at least looking after those women who have lost out in the retail sector in particular? I'm talking about when you think about the car industry, for example, and government intervention there and interest in it. Is it the same?
I mean, I think there is a really interesting kind of, you know, gendered kind of aspect here is when we talk about industrial strategy, everyone thinks, as you said, of kind of automotive, of heavy manufacturing. And of course, those are completely vital. But they think less about, you know, where is our retail industrial strategy? How are we making sure we have a kind of vibrant high street and that's providing decent jobs? Of course, part of that, as Vicky says, would be to be getting pay rising for everybody. Again, we've seen pay today still not hitting its pre-crisis peak. And that is, of course, holding back some of the kind of consumer spending we need to support the high street. But I do think we need to look at the kind of retail sector as a whole, and I think there's something really interesting happening where you're seeing kind of predominantly female jobs in shops, basically, replaced by what have been seen as traditionally kind of predominantly male jobs in warehouses. And, you know, we need to kind of look at the quality of those jobs as well, because that's often also making that work invisible. We've heard quite a lot about kind of conditions in those warehouses, not great in general. And I think our kind of retail industrial strategy, which is what we definitely need, also needs to look at the conditions in that kind of online sector too.
The thoughts of Kate Bell from the TUC and Vicky Price, the economist and author of Women versus Capitalism. Here's a rather bleak assessment from Leslie, who says, applying bald economic principles to issues like women's pay, I think it's a waste of time. Women are often desperate. They will take anything that pays more than benefits and or which allows them to also look after their children. They're faced with a perpetual dilemma. Take that boring, badly paid job, or another woman will. It's ironic and sad that women are driving wages down to their own disadvantage. Well, we talked there about retail. We should also acknowledge modest fashion is a big part at the moment of the online offering from many fashion stores and operations. It's having a real moment, modest fashion, but many people, or even though they may actually be following the trend, won't know much about it. So we talked this week to Rena Lewis, who's Professor of Cultural Studies at the London College of Fashion, and to Amina Begum Ali, a model with the world's first modest modelling agency, Umma Models. We're told the UK's fashion industry is worth £32 billion, according to the British Fashion Council. But I asked Rena what the modest fashion industry was worth globally.
The most recent figures suggest that it's worth $283 billion in 2018 and predicted to rise to $402 billion by 2024. So it's a big and growing market.
All right. I'm going to ask you, Amina, to define it. What do you understand by the term modest fashion?
I think it's all personal. Like, I think what society does, and especially with mainstream media, I think it's people focus way too much of it being outer, so what you wear. So when I think about modesty, I think about the way I speak, the way I act and how I carry myself and how people perceive me as a Muslim woman, essentially. So, but then again, I say that, but I feel like there's so many other people that could be modest, you know, like you can, there could be people who just don't agree with wearing, you know, revealing clothing.
Yeah.
And then you can, there's so many different religions as well. So Jewish women, they decide to cover their hair as well, which is the same concept as us. So I feel like when it comes to modesty, we shouldn't like just say it's Muslim women, essentially, because that's not the case.
And for some of our listeners, perhaps the older people, yeah. How would I know that you were modestly dressed?
I just think by, well,
what would you modestly cover your arms? And
I just think overall, I wear pretty modest clothes. Like I cover my arms. Well, this is what I said, because yeah. when I first saw you, I was like, I actually would wear your outfit, yeah. but just with a hijab.
Right.
So this again is religious, but I think there's other women who don't wear hijab who are significantly modest too. And I think modesty can't really be defined unless you, like, if I'm talking about Muslim context or what it says in our scriptures, but then that can go with anyone. So you can consider yourself quite modest and you don't have a religious faith, you know? So that's kind of where I come from. I just think it's all personal.
Yeah, okay. Are you at all resentful that the big fashion brands are now, I don't know, encroaching on this area? And of course, they're in the business of making money. We've just talked about how difficult it is out there for retailers. Are you angry with them, or do you just think, well, let them do it?
Well, I think let them do it. But also, I feel like if you're going to use it, use people who are genuinely modest. So use a Jewish woman who wears, do you know what I mean? Use us.
You mean in the imagery? And
yeah,
the,
yeah, exactly. So use us and promote us instead of, you know, getting a woman for a brand and then putting just a hijab on it because she doesn't understand the meaning behind any of it. But then I also think that we've been doing this before this industry existed. There were Muslim women who curated their outfits to begin with. So this figure, yes, it's there, but you also need to understand that when this industry didn't exist, there were women who were taking dresses with short sleeves, etc., and making it modest. So what really is the modest industry?
Because, well, that's a good point.
Do you see what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, I do. Rena, what would you say to that?
I think that's a really good point. Women around the world from different religious and faith communities have been dressing modestly on trend centuries.
Some people would also say dressing practically.
Well, I think lots of women, you know, you said earlier what you're wearing could count as modest, and indeed it could. And you're not, I'm guessing, necessarily dressing in that way for reasons of religion or religious community cultural convention. So the way
it's quite cold is one of the reasons.
Yes, and you may also wear a swimsuit on a public beach. So, or not. It's not the garments, it's how people are wearing them and why they're wearing them. So I think what's different now, women from different communities have dressed according to their understanding of modesty for generations. What's different now is that there is a commercial niche market which initially developed, led by women entrepreneurs from within faith communities,
yeah.
who wanted to make and sell what they couldn't find in the shops.
Well, I suppose this is
now
what
the global industry is interested.
Yes, are women who are actually living this life making money out of the current trend, or is it the usual suspects making money out of all this?
I think that the niche modest fashion brands are seeing a bounce. I think it's an interesting question with any niche when the mainstream industry, whether it's mainstream food companies doing organic, start to get interested in the niche, it both raises awareness, which creates more market opportunities, and it brings in market competitors who have more money to spend on research and design, on advertising, and mm-hmm. so on. And I think the other thing I'd say in relation to your question about how would anyone looking at Amna know that she's dressed modestly? Well, in this case, the fact that she's covering her hair with a headscarf is a sort of Belisha beacon of Muslim woman in the street.
Yeah.
And that makes you hyper-visible. Of course, lots of Muslim women who also dress modestly for religious and cultural reasons don't consider it necessary to cover their hair. And they are invisible both to other Muslims and to people from outside that community.
Yes.
It's quite hard to tell sometimes.
I'm sure. Men and modesty. What about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of men in the, like, for example, Sikh men. They wear turbans, so they have a ruling where they have to cover their hair. And it's the same thing. There are some Sikh men who, you know, choose not to cover it. So I wouldn't know whether they're Sikh or not. But I feel like that never gets talked about. You know, and
it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But then also within my religion, there's a hijab for men. So there's certain things that they can't show in. And we never speak about it because it's never spoken about in society. I think women are more, we get more picked at because it's just life, isn't it? We live in a man's world. That's what we get told. But I feel like in every situation, if a woman who's, you know, like a public figure, if she takes a hijab off, is scrutiny. But then you won't see the same happen to a guy.
I would come in there and say that many women from within communities where there are conventions of modesty would often say, in response to the accusation, aren't men forcing you to do this? You know, of course, not all women can exercise choice around the world about how they dress. But also many women will say, well, we have codes of modesty in dress and behaviour for men as well. But exactly as you're saying, women bear the burden both of demonstrating cultural authenticity and tradition. And also women are scrutinised. When I walk down the road, I am much more scrutinised and surveyed for how I look than a man walking down the road. Men can turn up looking shabby if they want to. Women get judged in a different way. Yeah. But I do think that menswear is going to be a new area that the market's going to look at.
Rena Lewis and Amina Begum Ali talking on Women's Hour this week. If you have just heard, and if you've been listening to Radio 4 all afternoon, you will just have heard, the play by Shelley Silas about the trial of Radcliffe Hall. You might be interested to know that we talked about that on Women's Hour on Friday, and you can find that edition of the programme on BBC Sounds. We talked about the novel, The Well of Loneliness, as well, and got a really interesting cross-section of views from people who have read the novel, people who couldn't get hold of the novel, although they wanted to, people who thought the novel was terrible but important. So it's really interesting. So if you did hear that play this afternoon, you might well want to go back to Woman's Hour on Friday, and you can get that on BBC Sounds. You can hear a discussion about The Well of Loneliness. The population of Earth has doubled since 1970, and it's heading for 10 billion by 2050. Could having fewer children be an answer to the challenges that face us? Would you consider having a smaller family for the sake of your planet? Is that something that came into your thinking when you were planning your family? Or is the real issue overconsumption, not overpopulation? That was the question we put to you on Monday in a phone-in edition of Woman's Hour. My guests were Professor Sarah Harper, Director of the Oxford Programme on Fertility Education and the Environment, and Anna Hughes, who is child-free for environmental reasons. She's also the director of an organisation called Flight Free UK, which campaigns against flying. Now, here's a listener called Becky who called in.
I wanted to kind of call in because I feel like I'm sort of coming to the point where all of these decisions are going to be sort of very relevant to me. And I have been for a while now sort of debating, you know, where I feel on, you know, on the fence in terms of, you know, should I or should I not? And climate and the kind of, you know, the impact of bringing another person into the world is very much at the kind of forefront of my decisions and what I'm weighing up at the moment. And I think, you know, within that, there's a few different things. And I feel kind of, you know, very strongly the kind of climate side on one side is pushing me in a direction. But I, you know, I can't help but deny there is a part of me that would also would like to go ahead and have children. But there's a part of me that feels like actually there is an element of selfishness in that in some sense. And probably, you know, some people might hate me for saying that. But
okay,
but
Sarah's shaking her head at that mention of selfishness. Yes. So Sarah,
well, I mean, I think what I'm really worried about, although obviously, you know, I really respect people like Anna because they have made this decision. But I would hate young women who would like to have children to feel that they can't have children because they've got to save the planet, because there are so many other things that you can do. And I think having children, as I say, in this country, it is a choice and it's a wonderful thing. And if you have that child, just make it a low consumption child. And if you really feel so concerned about overpopulation, then give money to NGOs, work for an NGO, set up an enterprise to help African women. I mean, there are so many other things that we can do. But if you really, really want a child, then, you know, I don't think you should be frightened into not having a child or feeling guilty because you want that child.
Well, I guess the thing is I don't know if I do or I don't at this point in time. And I do appreciate what you're saying. But I think coming back to what some of the people were saying on Twitter, I wholeheartedly agree that there's so many people out there who seem, you know, who seem kind of conflicted on this decision and what they should do. And I think, you know, this point around why aren't more people kind of considering, you know, adoption and fostering as options? Mm-hmm. I definitely am. You know, that's actually almost my kind of first port of call, I think, before thinking about, you know, having my own biological children. And I think we live in a society where people are so kind of occupied with, you know, having their own children. And just, I think people need to be aware of, well, actually, you can be doing, you know, something fantastic and, you know, having less of an impact on population if you explore those options. I don't know why more people don't think of those initially before kind of jumping to the assumption that I'm going to have my own.
Best of luck to you, Becky, whatever decision you reach. Joyce, tell us what you think about all this.
Well, when I was growing up in the 1960s, my mother said, one thing, don't ever have more than replacement level children. I said, what's replacement level? She said, well, when the mother and father dies, two children, so you don't have a net contribution to the global population boom. And so my sister had one child and I had none, and I feel the discrimination. I don't have any regrets, but there's such a focus on children. The number of television programs about children, that every politician says families, not people or individuals. Families this, families that. And yet, when you go to theater, it's much easier to get a nice seat if you're single than if you have a group. So it's worked for me.
Yeah.
And I get really sort of disgusted when I see people having four or five children and then getting angry in the newspapers that their kids can't get into the school of their choice. Well, if they had one or two, maybe they would get into the school. So this talk of consumption, I think it has to be relative to the communities where you live in. Obviously, the huge queues at the hospitals and the schools and all this kind of stuff have to do with population, overpopulation.
Okay, Joyce, thank you very much. Let me put that overpopulation point to Sarah. There are just too many of us, says Joyce.
Well, I think to a certain extent, if you look at it globally, that is correct. In Europe, however, our population would be declining if we didn't have migration.
Well, and Deborah on Twitter says, in this country, we are having or we are reaching a caring crisis. We need more babies.
Yes. So one of the reasons why both France and the UK are actually relatively young is because we've always had a very healthy immigration into our country. And we have not replaced ourselves in this country since 1976.
So our population would have shrunk migration.
Without migration. Now, obviously, migration causes problems at the local level and integration and the rest of it.
Always. Yeah.
Well, but on the other hand, if from a demographic point of view, that's how the world could solve this problem, by balancing out its population so that those high reproductive countries, people were free to come to the aging countries in the Northern Hemisphere. So when you say we're overpopulated because we overconsume the Earth's resources and we clearly cannot continue that. But we could solve a lot of the problems around the ageing population if we, you know, enabled people to move more freely around our planet.
Anna?
Yes, a lot of people do say the answer to the ageing population is to have more children. But of course, that only defers the problem and it creates other problems. So yes, it's about restructuring. It's about balancing out, as you said. And also, we can't forget that we're in a climate crisis. And one of the effects of climate crisis is going to be migration. Climate migrants, that's going to be a massive problem
for us.
Well,
I have to say,
you know, yes, I've chosen not to have a family, but that doesn't mean that I don't have children in my life who I care about. I'm terrified for the future of my niece and nephews.
Marilyn is in South London. And Marilyn, well, you've had two children, am I right?
Yes, that's right. I have had two children. I was reminded of an amazing geography teacher back in the 70s who introduced me to the whole business of overpopulation, on the basis of that, we decided to only have two children, which, and this was a huge surprise to me. I absolutely adored being pregnant. I absolutely adored the process of giving birth, and I grieved all the way through my second pregnancy, the fact that we weren't going to be doing this again. But it's something that I felt so strongly about. I felt we could only really replace ourselves given the state that the planet was kind of, even in those days, I was aware that there was an issue. And it's a sacrifice. If you adore having children, you just have to find other ways of being in touch. I went on to become an antenatal, postnatal teacher, and I had kind of care of other people, about 500 babies, which was wonderful.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Catherine.
I was just really going to say that I'm 57 years old, and we decided when I was 28, my husband and I, that we weren't going to have children because we didn't feel that the world was going to be sustainable. And we felt that it was a very difficult future for children. But given that you love your child more than anything else in the world, I felt that I couldn't inflict that on another generation. But instead, I was sterilised at 28 by a doctor who just had a little boy. So that was a bit of an interesting thing.
And did the doctor try to persuade you against it?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. But I was so determined. I think it's unusual for a doctor to take the word of a 28-year-old like that, but he did. And I've not regretted it. I've got dogs instead, and I've had a lifetime of teaching. So I work with other children, other people's children, right. And it's a great joy.
Catherine, Marilyn, Joyce, Becky, and our guests in the studio, Sarah Harper and Anna Hughes. Now, are we always honest about female relationships? Can they be a little more complicated than we might like to think? A new play exploring this issue opened this week at the Royal Court Theatre in London. It's called Scenes with Girls. Lou and Tosh are characters in the play. They share a flat. Rebecca Morell plays the part of Lou. And the play has been written by Miriam Batty.
Female friendships have kind of been the most seismic and influential relationships I've had. And sometimes I feel like they are somewhat pushed aside or considered not to be seismic in the way that they're written about. And I wanted to write something that I felt was really honest and showed the complexity and sometimes the real difficulty that can be found in female friendships.
What drew you to the part of Lou, Rebecca?
When I read the script for the first time, I was really struck by its formal inventiveness combined with a kind of unnerving I recognised something in a sort of very familiar, unfamiliar, which was very unusual.
Did you recognise yourself in Lou then?
I think, well, interestingly, when I first read it, I kind of felt a separation between myself and Lou, and I felt, oh, this will be really interesting as an actor to be able to step into a skin which is very real but feels very really not mine, just in terms of her behaviours and the way she speaks and stuff. But then as the process has gone on, I think that space has definitely, I felt the gap close. And I think that's the point about this play, is that it's easy to come and kind of see these women and sort of look at them as items in a kind of petri dish that they're far away from you. But actually, they're all of us. And I think that's the brilliance of the writing.
Now, she's the one who talks about sex a lot and gives numbers a lot. How common do you reckon it is to show off numbers and details of your sex life, even to a best friend?
Well, I can only speak from personal experience, but I think that for me, I'm really glad that Miriam's just showed something I believe to be true about the female experience, which is that we're sexual beings as well. And I think that Lou's speaking about sex a lot. I mean, it's interesting because it's her and Tosh, her best friend. They both see themselves as part of a whole. They've both rejected the kind of traditional narrative that is heteronormativity, which is settling down and finding the one, the 2.5 kids and the Volvo, right? And so her talking about sex and going on with all of these kind of sexual adventures, it's kind of, to her, it's a way of rejecting the narrative. That's how she does it. So I think, yeah, I think in terms of her talking about her sex life to her best friend, what they're talking about is sex, but what's really happening in the subtext is two people validating each other's experiences. Lou, it's fine for you to go and behave how you want and to have sex with who you want. And Tosh, it's fine for you to not want to have sex. That's absolutely fine. And they validate each other.
Why did it feel so important to you, Miriam, to write that aspect of it?
There's an idea that there's like a type, there's types of women and they're kind of all butting up against each other and challenging each other. And I sort of thought, I wanted to show, I think that we're complicated and it's not just about the way that we're perceived by a potential desirer or a man or a woman, if that's your sexuality. Like, it's not that we're not simple. And I just wanted to write something deeply complicated. I have no answers. And I just wanted to basically open up a space to expose some of the conversations that we have, but also explore how the kind of expectations of the world come and seep into even a space that you think is really safe.
You're not afraid to look at their, at times, irritation with each other.
Yeah.
And it really surprised me to watch that, because really? It seems to me so often, you know, we've talked about sisterhood and how we're all good to each other and we're all kind to each other. How brave did you think you were being to show that they might be irritated with each other or they might bitch about each other?
It's sort of interesting. I don't think it's brave. I just wanted to be really honest. And I think it is really important, and particularly like in plays, that you try, or like my aim and my dream is to show something that's true. I think that sometimes female friendships are shown as though they're soft and kind of fun and simple and kind of cute, and you can kind of put them under the simplistic banner of like girl power. And actually they're to really, I think, show the kind of wonderful, curious potential of a friendship and the life-affirming nature of a friendship, which I think they are the most essential and important relationships we will have in our lives. That's my opinion. You have to show every facet of them. You can't just show them to be... It's not just... I don't want to write a play where women are just nice and cute and supportive of each other and active listen. I want to show that we're kind of all really trying to be good. We're trying to be good women. We're trying to be good feminists. I want to show the truth of the complication of that. And I think that in doing that, you show people to be human.
Rebecca, both you and Tosh are very relaxed. You're wearing flop-at-home clothes, no makeup, but you're very critical of Fran's lack of taste when she comes in. You're really quite nasty about her. Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, I think, I don't want to give spoilers. I think that what's really interesting about the play is, as an actor, it's very interesting to step into somebody who is as complicated as Lou. And yes, is mean. And people are mean sometimes. And she doesn't like Fran because, to her, Fran represents a person who has never had a problem in her life, a person who has never had to think about, for somebody for whom life is simple because that is just the way it has always been. And whether that is correct or not, that's not how Lou's life has been. And she, I think, feels some resentment over that. And she's only 24 years old. I mean, I remember being 24 and it's a turning point in your life. You know, I think that this play really stages a moment of mutual becoming, where all of these women have left the person they once were and aren't quite sure who they're about to become. But if this play was staged 2 years earlier or 2 years later, it would look completely different. And I don't know whether they would even know each other in the same way.
Miriam, that there's no sexual attraction between the women, but would you say Tosh and Lou actually love each other?
It's a great question. I'm so interested in this love and what it means. I think we kind of sometimes... I mean, I've always been troubled my entire life by the idea that romantic, amorous love is prioritised. Like, that's just something I've always found to be quite baffling. And I do sometimes wish there was more space for different kinds of love to be accepted as maybe the most life-affirming love that you could have. I sometimes wonder if there should be more space for people who... I mean, I'm always interested in writing characters, like women, because I'm always interested in writing women who maybe feel themselves to be difficult to love or haven't felt that who aren't maybe like Fran's character, seemingly walked into a relationship that has been accommodating to her. So I'm kind of interested in that, yeah.
Miriam Batty and Rebecca Morell, and the play Scenes with Girls is at the Royal Court Theatre in London until the 22nd of February. Now here's a lovely life-affirming email from Marianne. My friend and I have been friends for 70 years. We met when we were 7 at the local church, and this year we'll be 77. There was a long gap, beginning in our late 20s, when we didn't see each other because of work and family commitments. There was just the old Christmas and birthday card exchange, with that familiar message, "We must meet up soon." Then, in the year we were 60, we decided we would meet, under the clock, at Waterloo Station in London. It was as if the years rolled away and we chatted all afternoon. I know she'll always be there for me and I can just be myself when we're together and know that no matter what, we will always be friends. Marianne, that's lovely. Thank you very much for that. Over the next month, in fact, on the programme, we're going to be exploring the significance of female friendship, and we would love more of those sorts of stories. So if you've got any, and by the way, they don't all have to be 100% positive, because as that play acknowledges, this business isn't easy. Female friendships are no easier than any other relationship, it turns out. But do let us know how those sorts of friendships have helped you during the course of your life. We'd love to hear from you. Email the programme via the website bbc.co.uk/womanshour. Now, it's not easy to satisfactorily feed a family of four. There is a lot of carping just about wherever you look. And it also, this time of year, can be an expensive business when the credit card bills start to come in after Christmas. Lorna Cooper from Paisley found a way to cut her weekly food shop down from about 100 quid to 20. She is the founder of Feed Your Family for 20 quid a week.
I was spending too much money on a weekly shop. I had to stop work because I had injured my back and the finances didn't support spending 100 quid in the supermarket every week. So I started looking at the food budget and brought it down a wee bit and then brought it down a bit more and then sort of really got into it and thought, you know, this is great. This is a challenge.
Well, you weren't bringing it down. You weren't someone unused to challenge because your mum died when you were very young.
Yes, she
and
did.
You and your sister ended up living together when you were still teenagers and you were doing all the managing.
We were cooking for ourselves. We were basically looking after ourselves. Her dad was still financially supporting us, but we weren't cooking meals. We were heating things up, really, and that's being generous, you know.
So take me into your world then. What would be an average tea time meal in those days?
I would be, you know, a crispy chicken fillet with sort of and breadcrumbs in the oven with maybe some potato wedges and a tin of peas.
Yeah, well, that was all you knew and that's what you did. And, of course, by the way, it would feed you and it would keep you warm and you'd be reasonably nourished,
yes,
right?
Yep.
Fast forward then to today.
Okay.
And I want to know, quite simply, how much time you have to set aside to make this work, because 20 quid over 7 days, three meals, can't emphasise that enough, for four people, I don't know how you do it, so tell me.
So the hardest thing is working it out. It's writing the plan. It's doing the shopping. It's that's what took me the longest to work out. It's planning, and that does take time. The actual cooking itself doesn't. It's not. You know, I'm not asking you to stand in the kitchen all weekend batch cooking. And
although that there is a bit of that, isn't
it? Well, there is, but not. Not taking any extra time out. So what I say is when you're batch cooking, I mean, you make a lasagna, make two, put one in the freezer. It doesn't take any more time to do that. And, you know, and it's the same with cottage pie or making a curry, you know, just double it up and then put half in the freezer. And then that's you get a meal for another night when, you know, things haven't gone right that day or you're running late or kids have got clubs and you don't have time to stand prepare something. You just take it out the freezer into the oven.
Buying in bulk, what about that?
Yes, so if you can, buy in bulk. Look at other suppliers, not just your standard supermarket, so farm shops, markets, online suppliers. If you can't afford to buy in bulk, then consider asking your sister, your mum, your aunt, your cousin, your friend from work or the other mums at the school gate.
Effectively form a kind of food collective or club.
Go to the farm, buy a £56 bag of potatoes for £3.50
and divvy it up.
And yeah, basically, yeah.
I'm surprised more people don't do that. Now, meat, because you recommend, I thought, an interesting source of meat supplier. I'd never heard of this.
Yeah, so I was browsing online one day, found an offer for an online... It's basically a company, a butchers, basically, that supply bodybuilders. And they sell 5 kilos of chicken breasts and, you know, 10 sort of rump steaks. And it's all discounted because you're buying in bulk. They obviously started for the bodybuilders because they focus on protein in their diet. But, you know, I've been using them for years now and I buy 10 kilos of chicken breasts and I divvy them up into twos and put them in the freezer. And it lasts me months and months and months.
Fussy eaters, because kids can be a nightmare.
Yes.
What are your tips there?
Hide the vegetables.
Or just by doing what?
I started making a pasta sauce. I call it my tomato-based sauce now, but it just started off as trying to replicate, you know, the branded pasta sauces for lasagna. And then I realised that it was a base, and my kids liked, you know, creamy bacon and tomato sort of pasta sauce, and I went to the supermarket and I turned it round and I looked and I read the ingredients and I thought, oh, I can do that, just need to add some herbs or add a wee bit of bacon or add this, and I started doing that. But the base sauce is basically a couple of tins of tomatoes, some tomato puree, some stock and a ton of grated vegetables, and it gets all cooked up. Cooked for a couple of hours slowly, and then blended with a hand blender, and it looks like red tomato sauce, passata, basically, maybe a wee bit thicker, and that goes in everything now. So any recipe that calls for a tin of tomatoes or passata It gets used, even gets used as a like tomato sauce on your pizza.
Right, OK, so, yeah, as the base layer for a pizza.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what you say about herbs, because actually it's a very useful guide in the book to the difference between dried herbs and fresh herbs.
Yep.
I was reading the other day about a woman who puts her dried herbs in alphabetical order, which I think, honestly, is my little tip.
Yeah, that's good.
Because I always find I've got any number of bits of one sort of herb and none of the other, because I keep thinking I haven't got it.
Uh-huh.
Is that what you do?
I actually go to the Asian supermarkets for my spices
they cheaper?
And herbs. Yeah. So, you know, you get your small jars and they're like £1 each. Even if you buy the sort of supermarket zone ones, you're looking at between 50 pence and a pound for, I think it's 85 grams you get in those wee jars. You can go to the Asian supermarket and you get 200 grams for £1.60.
In a bag?
In a big bag,
That's right.
And I've got loads of Kilner jars that I've bought over the years and they get decanted into them.
And do the dried herbs last long enough?
Yeah, they do.
They do. Okay. I've always wondered about that.
No, they don't go off. Like,
now, you're doing well as a result of your economy tips, I suppose. Are you still living on the 20 quid a week thing?
Yes. So I don't sit down now and write myself a list. I don't do a shop in the way that I ask people to do it in the book, because I feel like if you buy the book, you follow the 8 weeks, you've changed, you've re-educated yourself, and now you're in a phase of you're buying, stocking up certain things at certain times.
Mm.
So if you were to add up all my shopping over maybe 6 months and then divided it up, you would say, yeah, it comes to £20 a week, probably less actually now. But I see tin tomatoes in a supermarket and they're half price, I'll buy 24.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I'm at now. When I see something, when I need chicken, I'll go and buy 10 kilos and just fill the freezer back up again. You know, if people follow the plan, you completely re-educate, you change your thinking, it just becomes second nature.
Lorna Cooper, the founder of Feed Your Family for 20 quid a week, and she has a book as well, which may well be helpful to you. Caroline says, Lorna, great. I used to do a food co-op with friends. The issue for me is storage these days. And that is a good point, Caroline. I do get that. I know Lorna referenced buying loads of tins. And of course, not everybody's got the space to store them. Maggie says, I've just had from that conversation a really good memory of the 70s when I and my friend Shirley from next door, we shared a chest freezer for bulk buying. And this does make sense, doesn't it? It was kept in my house and she paid me 50p a week for the electricity. We carried this on for years. Really good times, and I encourage anyone to seriously consider it. Good point, and thank you very much indeed for that, Maggie. Join us live Monday morning, 10:02, or of course you can get the podcast. We'll have the third in our series talking about damaging patterns in relationships. Zakia McKenzie will talk about spending a year as Forestry England's writer in residence. And Marion Dunn tells us about taking up boxing at the age of 50. Woman's Hour, 10 o'clock, just after Monday morning. Have a good weekend.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.